those fear into my mind. What if it wasn't domestic violence? What if there's a serial kidnapper on the loose?
Meredith. 11 years before. March. The hospital parking garage is empty when I leave. It's 3:30 in the morning. I was with my client for nearly 7 hours, helping her deliver a beautiful baby boy that she and her husband named Zeppelin. It's horrible. He's only hours old, and already I'm imagining him being made fun of at school. But no one asked for my opinion. The husband, Matt, is an amateur guitar player and a diehard fan of 70s rock. They'd made up their minds weeks ago. All night, my phone was quiet. The only person to text was Josh, who said goodnight before he went to bed and told me he loved me. He doesn't ever ask how things are progressing or what time I'll be home. He knows better than to ask. He knows I don't know. Childbirth is rarely predictable. This delivery was relatively quick, as firstborns go. My focus was on my client and her baby. It was a welcome reprieve. I didn't have time to think about anything else, like those awful texts. But now, as I step onto the fourth floor of the parking garage, they come rushing back to me. I spot my car on the other side of the garage. I move quickly, a speed walk, just shy of a run. There are only a handful of cars here. Visiting hours ended eons ago. The cars still here belong to patients and hospital staff. Everything about the parking garage is cliché. It's poorly lit, dirty, and claustrophobic. There's a foul smell to it because the garage walls are solid with little ventilation. Even without the texts, the garage sparks fear. It belongs in a movie scene. It always scares me, but tonight, especially so. I reach into my bag. I carry pepper spray with me because long ago, Josh made me. He's always hated the idea of me out on the street or in abandoned parking garages late at night. I told him he was being ridiculous. I swore nothing bad was going to happen to me. But now I'm grateful for the pepper spray. I've had the same canister for years. It's probably expired, the ingredients degraded so that they wouldn't be much help if I needed them. But the weight of it in my hand is a relief. It's better than nothing. I keep my head up as I walk. I stay alert, scanning the parking garage with every step. There's no one here. The parking garage is empty. Still, there are darkened voids where I can't see, like in the corners of the garage where the lights don't reach. There are stairwells at each corner. The doors are open. Only a blackened hollow remains. If someone was there, standing in that blackened hollow, 3 feet back from the open door, I wouldn't know. I also wouldn't know if someone was behind me. I try to listen for footsteps, but there is some sort of supply or exhaust fan whirring in the garage. It dampens all other sounds. All I can hear is that fan. Twice, I glance back to see if someone's there, and no one is. Still, it doesn't fully suppress the fear. As soon as I turn back, the fear of being followed returns. I dig again into my bag. I find my cell phone, grip it in my hand. I don't want to call and wake Josh. I'd never hear the end of it. If he knew I was scared, he'd want to send a whole brigade with me to every birth I went to make sure I was safe. I consider a call to Kate or Cassandra or Bea. It would be a great comfort to have someone on the other end of the line, keeping me company. But it's 3:30 in the morning. I can't call and wake someone up. I hasten my pace. By the time I'm halfway across the garage, I've broken into a run. I'm sweating, my breath coming so fast that I have trouble catching it. My pulse pounds in my ears. I reach the car. I yank open the door and nearly dive into the driver's seat. I slam the door closed. I tap the button and activate the locks. But that's only a partial relief because there's still the fear that when I look in my rearview mirror, someone will be there. My fears aren't unfounded because of the text messages. I hope you die. I hope you rot in hell. I have every reason to be scared, though I've tried my best to convince myself that the texts are only a prank, that someone with a sick sense of humor is sending them, though I don't know anyone like that. I thrust my keys into the ignition. I start the car. Before I can throw it into reverse, there's a tap on my window. I scream, seeing only blackness filling the glass. Someone is standing beside the car. I can't make out a face. I grab for the pepper spray. The only other things I have to use are an ice scraper and my keys. The figure squats down, and there in the window is Jeanette, the midwife. I throw my hand to my heart. "Oh, God," I say, lowering the window and forcing myself to smile, to relax. "You scared the shit out of me, Jeanette." I take a deep breath. Jeanette is here in the parking garage with me. No one will hurt me while Jeanette is here. "Sorry," she replies, still on a high from the birth. They can be vitalizing sometimes, especially the ones like this that don't take 24 hours only to wind up in surgery. "I thought you saw me," Jeanette says. "I've been trailing you for a while. I called out for you." I tell her, "I didn't hear you or I would have stopped." Then she gets a mischievous grin on her face and says to me, "Zeppelin." And we both laugh. The kids will have a field day with that. "I feel sorry for the poor boy," I say. "He'll grow up hating his parents for it." "Whatever happened to Thomas and James?" Jeanette asks. Jeanette is older than me. She's more traditional. "Come on, Jeanette," I say. "Don't you know that Thomas and James have fallen out of rotation in recent years? These days it's all Jacobs and Noahs and Masons." "And apparently Zeppelins." "It's an atrocity," I say. We have a good laugh. "It's getting late," Jeanette says. "In just a few hours, the sun will rise. You better get home and try and sleep before your own babies are up." We say our goodbyes. I watch as Jeanette makes her way to her car parked farther down. Once she's safely in, I spin out of the parking garage, going fast. The relief washes over me when my car finally reaches the street outside. On the street, there are other cars. Building lights, street lights. It's still hours away from dawn, but the moon is nearly full, giving off additional light. A 24-hour McDonald's calls for me. And though I'm usually not a fan of fast food, I consider a run through the drive-thru because it's been hours since I've had a thing to eat. I'm famished, craving something greasy and quick. The relief is short-lived because soon after comes the familiar ping of my phone. A text message. It could be Josh, wanting an update. Now that Tuesday has become Wednesday, childcare arrangements may need to be made. He leaves for work early, by 6 o'clock. He'll need to find something to do with the kids if I'm not home by then. Though I will be, he just doesn't know it yet. He's being proactive. I grab my phone from the passenger's seat to see what he's said. But the text message isn't from Josh. It comes from the same unfamiliar number as the rest. Get home safe, it says.
Leo. Now. Dad took home videos of us when we were kids. Hours of them. Some nights, when he's being especially pathetic, he makes me watch. The girl in those videos is giddy, silly. She smiles a lot. She's always giggling. You, on the other hand, are dead serious. You look shook, scared. You're nothing like that girl anymore. You're someone new. I'm at school when Dad gets the call from the police. He comes to get me. It's fourth period honors algebra when he comes, which most people hate, but I like because it comes easy to me. Apparently, I'm good at math. Not that you care. The whole stupid class gets fired up when they call me down over the intercom because they think I'm in trouble. The truth? No one likes me. I'm the weird kid, the freak, the loser. I have you to thank for that. I don't get in trouble, though. The only time I get in trouble is when the other kids tell lies about me. Dad's waiting in the office when I come down. His eyes are red and watery like he's been crying, which is embarrassing as fuck when kids at school see your dad cry. Todd Felding walks by and sees, and I know I'm never going to live this one down. Dad and I leave, and together we go get you. They've got you in a room at the police station, and it's just you and the lady cop. She has a name. It's Detective Rawlings. I just don't like calling her that. Dad calls her that sometimes, but mostly he calls her Carmen. I'm not entirely sure, but if I had to guess, I'd say Dad and the lady cop have hooked up before. She's been there from the beginning and is, as Dad says, invested. Dad's so blind that he can't see she's got the hots for him. He thinks it's all about solving a cold case. Instead, it's about trying to get into his pants, which I'm sure she has more than once. Dad doesn't know it, but I've read the texts the lady cop sends him. They're mushy, sloppy, sentimental. They make me want to vomit. She massages Dad's ego, tells him she admires how brave he is, how gentle, how honest. I've been thinking about you, she sometimes texts. You and Leo are on my mind all the time. Gag. They've got a plate of food for you. You're eating, except that it's like you forgot how to eat, because you're doing it all wrong. You're thin. You've got pale skin. Your hands shake. Dad is so sure you're you that he rushes right up to you and gives you a hug. You go stiff. It looks to me like you stop breathing. You try to pull back, but Dad won't let you. He's crying. He's holding on for dear life. The lady cop has to lay a hand on his arm and tell Dad to give you some room. I'm embarrassed for him. I feel my own cheeks get hot because of the way he acts. You look just like your mom, he says, cupping your face in his hand. And from the pictures I've seen, you do. You both have red hair. Which is something, because only about 2% of people have red hair. I hang back by the door. I don't know you. Dad and the lady cop talk a long time. They stand too close. A DNA test is pending, but that doesn't matter because Dad already knows it's you. The lady cop suggests you get checked out by a doctor. She wants to check for evidence that you've been sexually abused. Dad looks like he might be sick when she says those words. Sexually abused. Like a rape kit, Dad asks. I've heard of that before. The lady cop says yes. She touches his hand, her voice going soft. It's precautionary, Josh. We don't know for sure that she's been sexually abused. But if we can find the person who did this to her, it will help convict him. She says there might be DNA evidence on you that will aid in their investigation. I don't like that she calls Dad Josh. I also don't like that she touches his hand when she says it. Dad's torn. He wants to help the police, but he doesn't want to traumatize you. The line between these things is thin. Eventually, Dad says yes, and we go to the hospital, where we sit in the lobby and wait. You go into the exam room with the nurse alone. Dad offers to go with you, to hold your hand, which is weird as fuck. The lady cop tells him no. She says it gentler than that. I don't think that would be a good idea, Josh. You're not 6 years old anymore, but try telling that to Dad. The lady cop sits with us during the whole entire exam. You shouldn't be alone, she says to Dad, though he isn't alone. He has me. I wish that she would leave. It takes so long, I think it will never be done. They confiscate your clothes. They send you home with something else to wear. There's never any question of if you are who you say you are, though the DNA results won't be back for another day. Child services could take you for the night. Child services is supposed to take you for the night. But after all that you've been through, the lady cop breaks the rules and lets Dad and me take you home. She tells Dad what you told them about where you've been. Dad nearly goes through the roof. It doesn't make sense, he says. And he's right, seeing as how Mom was found dead of a self-inflicted knife wound with a note. You'll never find her. Don't even try. The note went on to say that you were safe, that you were fine. If what you say is true, you weren't fine. You were far from fine. But maybe you're lying. No one thinks about that but me. We leave with promises to take you to a shrink and to our own doctor for a follow-up. They're worried about malnutrition, muscle atrophy, physical abuse. They're worried about your eyes. You have to wear special sunglasses because you haven't seen daylight in 11 years. At home, we're supposed to keep the blinds closed. They're worried about your feet. They're wrapped in bandages. If you had shoes, they took those too. They're also worried about your mental state. It's clear to see you're not all there. You're not right in the head. You're scared as heck. Wasted and emaciated. You should be 17, but no one would ever think you're 17. You could pass for 10. You've got no boobs. You're about 4.5 feet tall. You weigh maybe 80 pounds. We drive home. You ride in the back seat. You say nothing. It's a media circus when we get home. That's what Dad says as he steers the car through a crowd of reporters. A media circus. It makes me think of the reporters as clowns, as circus freaks, which they are. They step back so Dad doesn't run them over. Still, they take pictures through the car window. They shout questions at you. Those farther back crane their necks for a measly look at you. There are a buttload of them. They fight each other for a square foot of our lawn, which Dad says they aren't supposed to be on anyway because that's trespassing. He lays on the horn and they step farther back from the car. At the sound of Dad's horn, you spaz out, getting all twitchy. I feel sorry for you, but I don't know what to say to make it better, so I say nothing. I ask Dad how they know you're here. Dad says some shyster at the station or the hospital probably leaked to the media that you were back. Otherwise, how would they know? Your miraculous return is supposed to be kept on the down low. Dad's angry about it because if what you told the lady cop is true, then there's still someone out there looking for you. And if that's the case, these reporters will lead them right to our door.
Meredith, 11 years before. March. Dawn comes quickly. The morning after a birth is never easy. I wake to Josh leaning over me, kissing me before he leaves. What time is it? I ask, bleary-eyed. I try to shade my eyes from the morning sun that streams in through the break in the curtains.
Six,
he says.
There's coffee on the table beside you. What time did you get home?
Around 4. When I got home, it took me a while to fall asleep. I was scared, wondering if the same person who texted me had also followed me home. I thought about waking Josh and telling him what happened, but I didn't want to worry him unnecessarily. Josh already worries. He said it before, how he doesn't like me driving home alone in the middle of the night after a birth. Many, if not all, of the hospitals I visit have sketchy parking garages. Some of the hospitals are in the city, in rougher neighborhoods that I have to walk through to get to my car. There aren't many people on the street after nightfall. I've always been dismissive of his concerns. If anything, I've agreed to the pepper spray, to downloading some app on my phone that tracks my whereabouts all of the time. Josh feels better because of it.
This way,
he said, when he convinced me to download the app and accept his friend invite.
If you go missing, I can find you.
He said it in jest, and we both laughed at the time. But now it's not funny. It works both ways. I can keep tabs on Josh, too, though I never have. Josh has suggested before that I shut down my private doula practice and teach yoga full-time. He likes that yoga classes are held during business hours, that the hours are predictable, that the clientele is primarily female. I don't tell Josh about what happened last night because he'd want to reopen this discussion. That's not an argument I want to have. I love the practice of yoga, but teaching yoga can be repetitive, mundane. I couldn't do that for the rest of my life. I love what I do. I love the miracle of birth.
What did they have?
Josh asks, and I tell him a boy. Zeppelin, I say. He pulls a face.
As in the blimp?
He asks. I laugh. As in the band, I say. Not sure it makes it any better.
Do you want me to wake the kids?
Josh asks. But there's no need because I hear them down the hall, their feet hobbling toward our room. They appear in the doorway, all bedhead and out of joint. Delilah clutches her doll, Leo his beloved blue blankie. He never goes anywhere without that thing. He hangs on Delilah's arm, and already at 6 a.m, she's whining at him to stop touching her. Leo deifies Delilah. He can't get enough of her. All he wants is to be with her, in any capacity. He'll play hours of school, of house. Delilah, on the other hand, wishes he was a girl. A big sister, preferably.
Come on, guys,
Josh says as he stands before the floor mirror, tying a half Windsor knot into his houndstooth tie. Josh always wears a tie to work. He's always well-groomed. He wants to look good for his clients because looking good fosters confidence and respect. I get that. I stare at his reflection in the mirror. My husband is incredibly handsome. How did I get so lucky? I often wonder. The kids jump into bed with me. Before Josh leaves, he tells them to be good for mommy. Delilah finds the remote and turns the TV on. Together, we sit quietly in bed watching Bubble Guppies. Delilah lays her head on my lap, and Leo snuggles in closely beside me. I wrap my arm around him, wishing we could stay like this all day. Ever since Delilah started kindergarten, our days go by exceptionally fast. I miss the long, lazy days we used to have when they were younger. But before 9 o'clock comes, Delilah will be in school, Leo at the sitters, and me at work. I reach for the coffee Josh has left me and take a sip. An hour of sleep is never enough. The exhaustion wears me down, makes me feel physically ill. My phone is on the table beside me, volume turned up because it has to be. I never have the luxury of powering it down at night because a client might need me. I reach for it in the hopes that I somehow misunderstood the text messages from yesterday. I take a look, ever hopeful. Yet there they are, just the same as they were last night, instantly evoking fear. I hope you rot in hell, Meredith.
Kate, 11 years before. May. The next morning when I wake up, B is already gone. It was nearly 1 o'clock by the time I went to bed. I only got 5 hours of sleep, and even that was intermittent at best, because I kept thinking of Meredith and Delilah, hoping that by morning there'd be good news, hoping that by morning they'd be found. Now I take the servant stairs down to the kitchen and find that B is in her studio, working again because the back door is open. There are two staircases in our house, one in the front and this one, which is narrow, curved and tucked away in back, a passageway from the second floor to the kitchen, dating back to times when servants weren't meant to be seen. It's one of the reasons I first fell in love with the old home, for its history. Bea must have taken her own breakfast out to the studio to eat while she works. She's left me a plate. The cool, humid morning air comes in through the open door. B had the detached garage converted into a music studio when she moved in with me. It's a charming place, though one I rarely go inside, because it's B's workplace, much in the same way that she doesn't ever show up at my office. Boundaries are important in a relationship. B writes her own music in the garage. She records it. I know I shouldn't, but still I try and listen in sometimes, because Bea has a sexy voice. It's husky and rich and thick. You'd think she smoked a pack a day by the sound of her voice, but she doesn't. But unless she leaves the door open by mistake, I can't hear inside. I met Bea 6 years ago at a bar in the city where she was performing. It was the summer before vet school. I was working as a cocktail waitress to earn extra cash for school. We fell in love. 2 months later, I left for school. We kept in touch. B came to visit me. After graduation, I came back, got a job, bought a house. When B moved in with me, she didn't want to piss the neighbors off with her music. It's the reason we had the garage converted, making it soundproof. She figured the neighbors would already be pissed off enough with two gay women living on the street. The idea of a house in suburbia made Bea's skin crawl. She wasn't that type. But she did it for me. The house was close and convenient to my work. Bea could work anywhere. The house is a yellow 1904 Italianate in our town's historic district. It sits just a stone's throw away from a college campus, in an area more liberal than conservative. It's romantic, with brick walkways and 100-year-old trees. But that doesn't mean there isn't the occasional hatred and bigotry, because no matter where you go, you can't get away from that. Bea no longer performs in bars. These days, the only time I hear her sing is in the shower. For someone who loves to perform for a crowd, she's strictly against private performances. When Bea is writing music, she disconnects from the rest of the world. She tunes it completely out. It's when she's gone the longest that I know she's lost herself in her music, and I'm happy for her because of it. Bea is a born musician. She taught voice and guitar lessons for years, performed in bars and nightclubs. But that didn't satisfy her. It wasn't what she saw herself doing for the rest of her life. Now she's working on an album. That said, Bea isn't some freeloader. She carries her weight financially. She sold some of the songs that she's written and has a nice inheritance from a dead grandma who was apparently rich. I never met her. She was dead before I met Bea. Not only did Bea get her money from her, she also got her name, Beatrice, which is one of those vintage names someone else might hate, but not B. She adored her grandmother. A picture of them together sits on B's nightstand. When my back is turned, B steps inside. She closes the door and comes to me, wrapping her arms around me from behind. I turn to her, let her envelop me. B is in her pajamas still, the cotton shorts and Kurt Cobain shirt she wore to sleep. Her dark hair hangs long and straight, because somehow, inexplicably, B never gets bedhead. "I want to jump in the shower before they get here," she says. They, meaning the subcontractors who are working on her home. The house is old, and we're in the midst of a messy renovation. The house is full of historic elements, which we love. The ceiling medallions, the original oversized windows, the library with its built-ins, the servant stairs. They tell a story. But the bathrooms and the kitchen are 70s era, thanks to some previous owner who did a hack job on them. They lack the charm the rest of the house still has. We're getting those redone, brought back to a modern version of their original state, to restore the history and authenticity of the home. There's a combination lockbox on our front door. The workers come and go whenever they want. Their workday starts as early as 7 a.m. If we aren't quick to shower in the morning, they catch us in our pajamas. These men know their way around our house because they're here even when B and I aren't. It had never bothered me before. But now, in light of what's happened over the last 12 hours, it does. The contractor came recommended from Josh, who had work done on his own home. A 1890s Queen Anne. Apparently they're whizzes at keeping the integrity of historic homes. Meredith, though pleased with the final result, hated the invasion of privacy. She couldn't wait for their renovation to be through, she told us, saying how glad she was to have that lockbox removed from her door, to regain sole possession of her home afterward. I'm thinking now that B and I should take it a step further than that and have the locks replaced, because who's to say one of the subcontractors couldn't have duplicated the key? It makes my stomach hurt to think about someone besides B and me having a key to our home. Any news from Josh? I ask. It's early. I don't expect B to have heard from him, but as it turns out, she has. I just saw him, she says, telling me that he was in the backyard, letting his dog out. What did he say? I ask B, measuring out the coffee and pouring it into the filter. I hope for good news, but it's not. Meredith still isn't home, she says. He hasn't heard from her? No, she says. Not a word. The police came last night. I know, I saw them. What did they say? What are they doing to find her and Delilah? Not enough, according to Josh. He's trying to organize a search party himself, B says. He was outside making calls this morning, appealing to family and friends to help. I told him we'd help, she says. I nod and say, yes, of course. Anything, whatever he needs. I have the day off work, but even if I didn't, I would stay home and help search. Meredith and Delilah need me now. Finding them is all that matters.
Leo. Now. That first night in our house, you hardly speak. You don't say anything unless Dad says something first. You keep your head hung low. You don't look at us. You call Dad Sir. He tells you not to, but you do it anyway, because you can't stop. Every time you say it, Dad dies a little inside. I see it in his eyes. You cower in the corner of rooms, looking scared as hell. You don't know what to do with yourself, with your hands, with your eyes. Dad tells you to have a seat because he's so worried about your feet, which were full of glass and thorns and flint when the cops got to you. Docs had to pick it all out with tweezers. You didn't flinch, because I'm guessing that's not the worst thing that's ever happened to you. When Dad tells you to have a seat, you drop to the floor. We're in the kitchen when it happens, in a room with six chairs. Yet You pick the floor. Dad looks shook, but goes on as if it's no big deal because he doesn't want you to feel all weirded out by calling you out for it. So instead, he makes turkey sandwiches, and we all eat on the stupid floor. Except you don't eat much, because two sandwiches in one day is like 500 more calories than you're used to, and your stomach can't handle it. You try to eat. You look hell-bent on eating, but you also look like you could puke. I tell you, you don't have to eat it if you don't want to, because I can see in your eyes that you think you do. When Dad goes to take your plate away, you pull back fast. You whimper a little, like you think he's going to hit you. It gives Dad pause. Sure, we both know you got roughed up while you were gone. That goes without saying. But knowing it and seeing it are two different things. I feel bad for you, thinking all the time that someone's going to sucker punch you. I've been beaten up by kids at school before. I know what it's like. Except that at school, there's always some teacher there to pull kids off me. Though that's not necessarily a good thing, because I still get in trouble for fighting, and then I get crucified by kids for being a sissy. A 1-2 punch. But at least I don't get killed. I doubt you ever had anyone to stand up for you. I can't help myself. I stare at you. I don't remember what you used to look like, but I've seen videos and the pictures. You look almost the same as you did before, except you're bigger now, though hardly, and what were baby teeth are big and yellow and crooked. Your hair is bald in spots. I see Dad trying not to look at the bald spots, but they're hard to miss. Kids aren't supposed to be bald. Later, I ask Dad why he thinks you're going bald. I ask if he thinks you have cancer. He gets mad at me for that. He says, of course you don't have cancer, but he never says why he thinks you're going bald. I take my question to the internet. You might have alopecia, but more likely, you're compulsively pulling your own hair out, or it's falling out because of stress. When I read that, I feel like a jerk for thinking you have cancer. I tell myself not to stare at the bald spots anymore because I don't want to give you a complex. I wonder if you even know the bald spots are there. You talk like a redneck, which is weird as fuck since you come from an upper middle class neighborhood in the Midwest. But you haven't been to school since kindergarten, and whoever had you was probably some redneck meth head, and everything you know, you learned from him. Though mostly you don't talk, you just say, yes, sir, and no, ma'am. That night, the cops keep watch on our house. They sit parked in their police car, same as the news crews do, everyone vying for a piece of you.
Meredith. 11 years before. March. I've just stepped outside. The day is expected to be unseasonably warm, nearing 60 degrees. The morning starts off cold. It's only March. There are robins in the trees, making their way back from their winter homes. The kids and I are running late. We're rushing. I glance at the time on my phone. It's 8:30. I have to get the kids where they need to be and make it to my yoga class on the other side of town by 9 o'clock. I'll never make it. Cassandra is outside with Piper and Arlo. I see them heading off to school. The school is a couple blocks away, the distance short enough that the school doesn't provide a bus. We have to walk. Either that, or I have to drive Delilah to school. I never like to drive because the drop-off line is a nightmare. Some days I drive just close enough and then let Delilah off, letting her walk the rest of the way alone. I never feel good about it. She's only 6 years old. But there are other mothers and other children there, and also a crossing guard. Nothing bad will happen to her with so many people around. Delilah is street smart, She knows the way to go. She knows better than to talk to strangers or to be lured in by things like candy or kittens. But today I won't have to do that. I glance up at Cassandra, Piper, and Arlo across the street, heading out of their own home. They look like something out of a magazine. They're completely put together and holding hands as they trot down their stone walkway into the sidewalk. They're a picture-perfect family. Arlo is a toddler, yet he'll walk the distance without complaint. No one makes a fuss of holding hands. I look to my own children. Today, Delilah wears a dress. I combed her hair and found the elusive part, using a water bottle to tame the flyaway hairs. I managed a shower, and Leo got dressed all by himself, with his pants on the right way for a change. We don't look half bad ourselves, considering. On the outside, we're put together too. But inside, I'm all wrought up, my panic and agitation tucked neatly behind a smile. I'm getting by somehow on an hour of sleep. "Hey, Cassandra," I call out, waving across the street. We speedwalk to her and the kids. "Hi, Piper. Hi, Arlo," I say too eagerly. Delilah beams at her friend. She offers a shy wave, one that's only waist high. She's shy because of Cassandra and me. If there were no adults here, Delilah would be uninhibited. She's the extrovert in our family. I don't know where she gets it. It must be from Josh, not me. "I'm so glad I saw you," I say. "Perfect timing. Do you mind if Delilah tags along with you to school? We're running late," I say, knowing that Cassandra never has any issue with walking Delilah to school.
"Please?"
Piper pleads. Cassandra says, "Yes, sure, of course," which I knew she would. It wasn't like Cassandra was going to say no. They're headed in the same direction that we need to go, and really, one more child isn't a burden. Delilah tries to run off without saying goodbye. "Come back here, Missy," I tease. She giggles. She rushes back, wrapping her arms around my legs, and I hug back, inhaling the smell of her, a combination of syrup and shampoo. I remind her to be good, to do as Miss Cassandra says.
"Okay, Mommy," she says.
I watch them walk away, missing Delilah before she's gone. I remember her first day of daycare. That sick feeling in the pit of my stomach at leaving my child with a person I didn't know well. It's lessened over the years, but has never gone completely away. It was hard for me to go back to work after the kids were born, even though it was something I needed to do for myself. Delilah has broken up the formation. Now Delilah and Piper skip ahead, laughing, while Cassandra and Arlo lag behind, still holding hands. I feel somewhat guilty for unloading Delilah on Cassandra. Walking the kids to school is a favor I rarely get to repay. But Cassandra is autonomous. She's independent. By her own admission, she doesn't like to ask for help. I never get the chance to reciprocate. I take Leo to Charlotte's. I head to work. On my way, my phone pings and I break out into a cold sweat. I glance at the phone with reluctance, knowing I have to. It might be a client in labor. It's not. What it is instead is a variation of the same text I received last night. I gasp and drop my phone, but not before I've read the message. "I know what you did. You'll never get away with it, bitch."
Kate, 11 years before. May. B and I meet Josh in his yard just shy of 8 o'clock. It's early in the morning, but already he's gathered about a dozen people to search for his missing family. There are more on the way, Still, ours is a grassroots effort. We gather in a circle and talk about places Meredith and Delilah might be. Some ask for details about yesterday, and Josh, rubbing at his forehead, fills them in. He looks wired and high-strung, but also exhausted. His eyes are bloodshot. He's twitchy. I doubt he slept much, if at all. I look around. Leo isn't here. Josh left him with the sitter Charlotte, I assume. Charlotte watches many kids in the neighborhood. Even Bea and me, without kids of our own, know who she is. She's a staple around here. We see her and the kids out when the weather is nice, parading around the neighborhood. Charlotte is in her late 50s, 60, maybe. She lives alone with her husband. I wonder if Leo knows what's happening, if Josh told him. Does he know that Meredith and Delilah are missing? I doubt it, thinking that would be indigestible to a 4-year-old boy. Crayons go missing. Puzzle pieces go missing. Moms and sisters do not go missing. I wonder where Josh told Leo that they are. He would have had to be confused when he woke up and Delilah wasn't there. Among our search party is the woman who owns the yoga studio where Meredith works. Josh goes to her and apologizes for Meredith's absence yesterday. He says, "I hope it wasn't too much of an inconvenience." She says it was no inconvenience at all, that she and another teacher split Meredith's classes among themselves, same as they did last week when Meredith was sick, and the week before. Josh is taken aback, as are Bea and me. We exchange a glance.
"What do you mean?"
Josh asks. Because as far as any of us know, yesterday was the first time Meredith called in sick. I watch Josh's reaction. He's a tall man, a brunette with cool blue eyes. His eyes are moist, the blue turning somehow even more blue because of his tears. Leo, wherever he is, has the same eyes. The woman feels stupid. She turns red. She's misspoken. She fights for words, saying,
"It's just that yesterday was like the third time in 2 weeks that Meredith has called in sick. You didn't know?"
She asks Josh, and he shakes his head.
"We were worried. Until a couple weeks ago, Meredith was always so conscientious. This wasn't like her. We thought there was some real health crisis, like cancer or something."
And it sounds to me as if she's trying to make light of that. Meredith having cancer. Though I wonder if cancer would be preferable to whatever's happened. With cancer, she'd have a fighting chance. With this? I don't know. Another woman speaks. She introduces herself as Jeanette, a midwife with whom Meredith works on occasion.
"If I may,"
she says, explaining that Meredith had very recently made the decision to cut back on her workload, to spend more time with her family. She told Jeanette a week or so ago that she'd be taking on fewer clients and asked for recommendations of other doulas that she could send inquiries to. I see in Josh's reaction that he didn't know this either. His expression turns thoughtful, contemplative, but also sad. He runs his fingers over a mustache and beard. Frown lines appear between his eyes, one deeper than the other. Josh, like Meredith, must be in his mid-30s, just slightly older than Bea and me. He's not yet 40. I remember a conversation about whether they would go somewhere exotic when they both turned 40. It wasn't around the corner, but something they had time to think about and decide. Years away, but still on the horizon. Bea is the one who comes up with a strategy. It's so like Bea to take charge and be a planner. She divides us into groups with plans to search the town. Bea tells people to drive around looking for Meredith's car, to stop in restaurants and shops and see if Meredith or Delilah has been there recently. Josh gives us the make and model of Meredith's car, as well as the license plate number. The volunteers carve up the town among themselves, using major roads as their guide. Bea and I will stay and canvass the neighborhood, because we live here. Because we know the neighbors and we know our way around. Before anyone splits, Bea takes cell phone numbers. She starts a group chat so we can update each other with news. Josh sends a picture of Meredith over the group chat so we have it to show around. He gets choked up when he scrolls through and finds the image on his own phone. It's a picture of Meredith with Delilah and Leo, taken recently. Meredith is a beautiful woman. In the picture, her hair is gathered into a loose bun on the top of her head. Her skin is fair, covered in freckles, and her eyes are a stunning mineral green. She's clearly of Irish descent, dressed in some kind of embroidered shift dress that's as red as the hair on her head. I feel a pang of sadness at seeing the image of Meredith, with little Leo and Delilah wrapped beneath each of her slight arms. I pray nothing bad has happened to her or Delilah, who sits beside Meredith in the photograph, tiny and nearly toothless, staring lovingly at her mom and smiling so sweetly it makes my heart hurt. I may never have kids. Bea and I talked about the possibility of using donor sperm to get one of us pregnant. We got so far as to discuss which of us would be better equipped to carry a baby. Bea, who's larger in stature but also more maternal than me, and whether we'd want a sperm donor we knew, or if we'd prefer to keep it anonymous. I wanted to keep it anonymous, but that was too impersonal for Bea, too cold. She wanted to use the sperm of someone we knew, which felt weird to me. Bea and some man we knew having a child together? That's where the conversation ended. My eyes move to Bea's now. She stares over my shoulder at the picture. Her eyes are misty like mine. "They'll turn up," she says, her hand on my arm. And though she sounds so certain, she's thinking the same thing as me. What if they never come back? We've grown close to Josh and Meredith over the years. We've grown close to their kids. "They're fine. They have to be fine," Bea says, voice trembling, fighting tears. And I wonder if it's only wishful thinking. Are they fine? My gut tells me they're not. One by one, people get in their cars. They pull away, dispersing in different directions. Bea and I turn and move slowly down the sidewalk. We're quiet, each processing what's happening. The idea of something bad having happened to Meredith and Delilah is unfathomable. I won't let my mind go there no matter how much it keeps drifting. I have to stay positive for Josh's sake, for Bea's sake, for mine. As we walk, Bea slips her hand into mine. It feels good, having something to hold on to. We make our way to the first home. I knock, and when Roger Thames answers, I ask if he's seen Meredith. Roger is limping. He threw his back out working on his car, he tells us. That was last week, and he's hardly left the sofa since. He hasn't seen Meredith.
"What's the matter with her?"
he asks abruptly. Bea says,
"If you see her, can you just let Josh or us know?"
I've never liked Roger much. We turn and make our way back down the walkway and to the sidewalk, moving on. "Could she just be at a birth?" asks Gwen, the woman who lives on the opposite side of Meredith and Josh. Gwen is a widower. For 3 years now, her husband has been dead, Lou Gehrig's disease. I didn't know him well, but I remember that he went quickly. To me, it seemed like I'd no sooner heard the news than I read the obituary in the paper. I tell Gwen no, that we don't think Meredith is at a birth because of the fact that Delilah is also missing.
"Little Delilah?"
she gasps, her hand going to her mouth.
"I'm afraid so," Bea says.
Delilah is high-spirited. She's full of life. Everyone adores her.
"Delilah colors pictures for me on my sidewalk with chalk. I find bouquets of dandelions on my front porch from her. Last year, when I broke my hip, she carried my mail to the door every day. She's a darling girl."
Her voice cracks as she says it.
"I'm afraid I haven't seen Delilah or her mother for a couple of days. The weather," she tells us, "has kept me inside."
I say, "The weather has kept many people inside, I fear. Because of the relentless rain, everyone has been cooped up for days, blind to what's happening on her streets." Bea tells Gwen the whole story. As she does, Gwen's eyes fill with tears.
You'll let me know when there's news? She asks.
Gwen would join the search party if she could, but Gwen is nearing 80 and not as mobile as she used to be.
We'll let you know the minute we hear a thing, I say.
Most of our immediate neighbors know Meredith, though no one has seen her. They almost all want to talk. They step out onto their front porches and ask for details. Has something happened to her? They ask, everyone concerned. Meredith, like Delilah, is well-liked throughout the neighborhood. She's been known to drop everything to help a neighbor in need. When Gwen's husband was gravely ill, she helped get him in the car and drove him to doctor appointments when she could. When the Timmonses' little dog got out, Meredith walked miles around town, pushing Delilah and Leo in the double stroller until she found it. Bea and I share the little we know with our neighbors, but the information we gather in return is unremarkable. Jan Fleischer remembers Meredith's car parked in back. Tim Smith saw her pull down the alley.
Were the kids with her?
I asked him. He doesn't know. He didn't get a good look inside the car because there was a glare. He just knows that it was Meredith's car.
What time was this?
He shrugs.
8, maybe, or 9.
He thinks hard.
I had an appointment at 11, so I left the house around 10:30. It was before that. Sometime before 10:30, I'd say.
He decides, apologizing for being unintentionally vague. He feels badly for it, knowing he may have been one of the last to see her before she disappeared. B and I move on. This morning, it isn't raining. Still, the sky is full of heavy clouds. We feel the moisture in the air. The trees drip rain from last night's storm down on us, making us wet in spots. We carry umbrellas, but we don't need them. Not yet, though the humid weather does nothing for my hair. There are twigs everywhere, torn savagely from the trees and tossed to the street by the rain and wind. The sidewalk is riddled with puddles. Bea and I part ways and step around them. It's chilly outside, no more than 60 degrees. But the gray skies, the threat of rain, and the relentless wind make it feel more like 50. I didn't think to bring a coat, and I regret it. We cross the street and go to the house directly opposite Josh and Meredith's. It's a gray house that belongs to a young couple with kids. Bea and I don't know the Hanakas well, because families with kids tend to bond better with other families with kids, and Bea and I don't have any kids. But I've met them once. The Hanakas are friendly with the Dickies. I've seen Delilah and Leo riding bikes on the sidewalk with their daughter. I've seen Meredith and the other woman, Cassandra, talking on the street, laughing. Meredith likes Cassandra, I can tell. She speaks of her often on the nights Meredith, Josh, Bea, and me share a drink on the porch. It's never anything much, but somehow her name always makes its way into a conversation. Cassandra said the new bakery on Jackson has the best cinnamon scones. Cassandra and Marty are planning one of those Alaskan cruises next summer with the kids. Cassandra told me that a little baking soda and vinegar in the drains will get rid of those annoying fruit flies. Josh teased Meredith about it, said she had a girl crush on Cassandra, before looking mortified and apologizing to Bea and me, as if he'd said something to offend us. I don't know much about Cassandra and her husband Marty. Most of what I've heard is secondhand from Meredith. I know that they moved from the city. I know that, like Bea, they didn't relish the idea of suburban living. Yet, as their daughter approached school age, they had to choose between an extortionate private school education, a shoddy public school system, or moving to the suburbs. They came here. Bea and I step up to the door and knock. Cassandra comes. When she draws the door open, the house behind her is quiet, still.
I hope we're not bothering you, Bea says.
No, Cassandra says. Not at all. I just put my little guy down for a nap.
A cat circles her ankles. Cassandra scoops it into her arms and invites us inside.
You two look cold. Let me get you some coffee, she says.
And we step out of our shoes and follow her down the hallway and to the kitchen. Cassandra's home is tastefully decorated. Everything is in neutral tones and a touch too nice to belong in a home with little kids. It's also immaculately clean. Cassandra seems like the type. She's immaculate herself. She sets the cat on the ground.
You're here about Meredith, she says, taking the glass carafe from the coffee maker and filling it at the sink.
Cassandra is tall like Bee. She's blonde, with shoulder-length hair that parts at the center and frames her face. She wears a maxi dress that a woman my height could never get away with. I envy her for it. Cassandra knows about Meredith. Of course she does. She, like us, would have been one of the first people that Josh went to when he realized Meredith was missing.
It's awful what's happened, she says, back at the coffee maker, generously scooping ground coffee into the filter. I can't believe that she and Delilah are just...
She pauses, a pregnant pause.
Gone.
She reaches inside a cabinet and pulls out three matching mugs. She sets them on the countertop. As the coffee begins to percolate, Cassandra suggests that we sit down at the kitchen table and talk.
I haven't seen her in a few days, if that's why you're here. This weather,
she laments, sliding gracefully into a wooden chair across from Bee and me.
It's ridiculous. We've hardly been able to get outside at all. Piper has been begging for a playdate with Delilah. She absolutely adores her. Just this morning, Piper was asking if Delilah could come over after school. I put her off, told her I thought the Dickies had plans this afternoon and that Delilah wouldn't be able to play. I've never lied to my kids before, but I didn't know what else to say. Piper is inquisitive, always asking questions. She wanted to know what the Dickies were doing that Delilah couldn't play. I said they were going to the dentist. She asked if Delilah had any cavities. I said I didn't know. I hate lying to her. If Delilah doesn't come home soon, I don't know how I'll ever be able to tell Piper that something terrible has happened to her little friend, she says.
This would be hard for a child to understand. It's hard for me to understand. The area where we live is an area of low crime. Compared to national statistics or even the statistics of suburbs nearby, crime is nearly negligible.
I'm so worried, Cassandra says about Meredith and Delilah. Josh must be beside himself.
He's organized a search party, I say. And she tells us she knows that she plans to join the search just as soon as Arlo is up from his nap. Bee tells her that Josh is in the process of pulling together a list of phone numbers for Meredith's clients, family, and friends. When he does, Bee says, there will be people to call. Perhaps you can help with that while your son is napping.
Of course, anything I can do. They'll be okay, won't they?
Cassandra asks. Neither Bee nor I reply. We're quiet, contemplating the question. Will they be okay? No one knows. No one can say for certain. But Cassandra is staring at us, asking earnestly whether Meredith and Delilah will be okay. A tear leaves her eye, weaves down her cheek. I'm moved by the sudden show of emotion. Cassandra pushes herself from the table and goes to the coffee maker. She fills the mugs, asks how we take our coffee. She gathers the sugar and milk. With her back turned to us, she says, I saw something. Her words are quiet, but charged, full of meaning. They send a sudden shiver up my spine. I find myself wanting, desperate for more. Did Cassandra see something having to do with Meredith and Delilah's disappearance? She goes on, back still to us.
I'd forgotten all about it, she says. It came to me only after Josh called to tell me Meredith and Delilah were missing.
What'd you see?
Bee asks. Only then does Cassandra turn back to face us.
Someone outside their house, in the middle of the night, she says.
And then she makes the first of three trips to the kitchen table to deliver the coffees.
When?
I ask.
A couple weeks ago, she says.
Did you tell Josh? I ask.
No,
she admits.
I haven't. Not yet. I forgot. I only remembered late last night when it was too late to call and wake him.
This morning, her daughter Piper was around, and so she couldn't call and tell Josh then. She didn't want to scare Piper. By the time Piper went to school, the search was in full swing. Cassandra didn't feel right stealing Josh's attention away from the search.
Arlo, my son, she explains, He's a lousy sleeper. We're trying to sleep train, but easier said than done. Anyway, that night, the night that I saw someone, he was wide awake, crying. I was in his room trying to rock him to sleep. His room faces the street, she says. And without her saying it, I understand that Arlo's bedroom has a bird's eye view of Josh and Meredith's home. We never do pull the shades. We didn't when we lived in Chicago. You know what they say about old habits. They die hard, I say. There's a tremor to Cassandra's voice when she speaks. Whatever she witnessed out Arlo's bedroom window that night has her suddenly spooked. What exactly did you see? B prompts. My pulse quickens in anticipation. I wrap my hands around my coffee, but I don't drink it. I hang on to Cassandra's every word. It was dark out, Cassandra says. A moonless night. The streetlight outside has been out a month or two. My husband Marty called the city about it a while ago, but it still hasn't been fixed. Our tax dollars, she quips, hard at work. The only light came from whatever porch lights were left on overnight. For as dark as it was, I still saw movement in Josh and Meredith's yard. At first I thought it was my imagination, that I was seeing things. It was late and I was tired. Then when it didn't go away, I told myself it was their trees or a deer, a coyote maybe. But the longer I watched, I realized it was someone, people, in Josh and Meredith's yard. I watched for a while, not sure what they were doing, wondering if I should call the police.
Did you call the police?
B asks, knowing the answer. I wish I had, Cassandra says regretfully.
How many people did you see? I ask.
Two, she says. It didn't look like a break-in attempt. The people I saw, they weren't flush against the house. They were farther back, away from the door. I convinced myself, once I knew that what I was looking at was human, that they were college students heading home from the bars. It was after one. The timing felt right, she says.
Bars in town close at 1 o'clock during the week. There is student housing, both off-campus housing and residence halls just blocks from our home. It's entirely possible that whoever Cassandra saw that night were overserved college students heading home from a night at the bar, in which case, they were most likely doing something stupid but harmless that didn't require intervention by the police. I probably wouldn't have called the police either.
Did you get a good look at them? Do you know what they look like?
She shakes her head.
It was so dark.
What were they doing? I ask. Could you tell?
I couldn't, she says. But whatever it was, it didn't last long.
How long?
I don't know for sure, she says. Arlo had me distracted. He was all worked up, totally inconsolable that night. I was worried about him waking Piper and then having to deal with two crying kids in the middle of the night. I thought about opening the window a crack to see if I could hear something, but with Arlo crying, she says, it would have had the adverse effect. It would have just scared them away. I should have called the police, or at the very least, thought to tell Josh and Meredith about it the next day.
Why would you? B asks, trying to buoy Cassandra up. Drunk college kids is hardly news. They probably stopped to take a pee on the lawn.
But what if it wasn't just drunk college kids? She asks.
Listen, B says, reaching out to lay a reassuring hand on Cassandra's arm. Don't beat yourself up about it. The police will be at the Dickies today. I'll talk to them. Maybe someone on the block has a home security system they can pull. Video surveillance.
I tell her, that's a good idea, B.
I don't know that any of our neighbors have video surveillance on their homes. Even if they do, I don't know how much storage those cameras have. I don't know if they keep footage for weeks or if it's the kind of thing that disappears after a day or two. But it's worth a try, because maybe it was drunk college kids heading home from a night in the bars. Or maybe it was someone else. B and I drink our coffees quickly. I'm anxious to get back on the street and continue the search. We say our goodbyes. Cassandra walks us to the door, stepping outside with us. She watches us leave. We move on,
following a path of stepping stones through her sodden lawn, leaving Cassandra on her front porch alone. We stop at other homes on the block. When we reach the end of it, we turn the corner and keep going. Along this next block, many of the houses belong to the college. Some are